Bonsoir, mesdames, messieurs. Mon nom est Daniel Jutras. Je suis le doyen de la faculté de droit de l'Université McGill qui vous accueille ce soir. D'abord, je veux vous féliciter pour vous être rendu. It's quite an accomplishment. We are safe in this place. I think it's fair to say that you don't need to worry about the storm outside. If things get really bad out there, the great thing about our event tonight is that we have one of the most fabulous storytellers in Canada, and the physical setup actually lends itself to this. I don't think I've seen this kind of light in the Faculty of Law before. It's like fireside chat or au coin du feu avec Morris Fish. So if things get really rowdy out there, don't worry, we'll take care of it. And there's plenty of water to keep you properly hydrated. So I'm very happy to welcome you all, particularly to welcome Justice Morris Fish for this remarkable event. Morris Fish, of course, is l'enfant prodige de la faculté, trois fois diplômé de la faculté BA 59, BCL 62, et bien entendu un doctorat honorifique de la faculté de droit en 2001. Before you get to hear Mr. Justice Fish, there are, I think, four speakers altogether, so you will allow me to be very brief in this short welcome and say a few words of specific welcome. First of all, a very special welcome to Laura Fish, who's Mr. Justice Fish's daughter and is a graduate of this faculty. We haven't seen Laura in a little while. I'm happy to see you there and say hi. More generally, I want to say hi to people in the room who are friends of the library. There's people who can find their way to the library and actually spend a little bit of time there. Are a rarity in some environments, but not here. This is a scholarly environment, and everybody here knows where the library is. Welcome to the Friends of the Library, and most specifically, welcome to Mr. Nicolas Matossian, who is the friend-in-chief, I would say, or the president of the Friends of the Library. Welcome also, very special welcome, to Dr. Colleen Cook, who is the new Trenholm Dean of Libraries, joining us, newly appointed and joining us from Texas. And I'm sure that she's perhaps reassessing her decision to come from Texas to Canada today. Although I read the papers this morning, and Texas is not doing really well these days, minus 40 degrees with the wind chill factor and 60 centimeters of snow. So by comparison, what we have here is pretty mild, and you will enjoy Montreal, I'm sure. Also, a special word of welcome to Harvey Yourofsky, who will be introducing our guest speaker tonight, former partner of Mr. Justice Fish in the firm of Yarosky Davio, now the firm of Yarosky Davio, but back then a very strong partnership in criminal law between the two of them, and I'm sure he will have some interesting stories to tell us before we hear the stories from Morris Fish. And then another special word of welcome. You can see that I'm going down my list as quickly as I can. Special word of welcome to Mr. Justice Alan Hilton, who is, I think, responsible, first and foremost, for bringing Morris Fish to the faculty tonight for this very special lecture. And you will see that, being the modest person that he is, he will not be speaking today. He's just sitting there and enjoying the show like the rest of us. Last word of welcome to the alumni of the Baron Byng High School. I think there might be some in the room. The famous Baron Byng High School, where Morris Fish studied. And I think Mr. Yourofsky also studies. Absolutely. So we have a bunch of alumni of this high school that was once described by a journalist as existing only in the imagination of Mordecai Richler. So whether or not it existed, it certainly produced an extraordinary roster of alumni. Welcome to those of you who are from this group, and I have the very pleasant task at the end of the evening of saying my appreciation on your behalf, my appreciation to Mr. Justice Fish. So without further ado, I will pass the podium to the long string of people who will express their excitement at the presence of Mr. Justice Fish in our midst tonight. Bienvenue à la faculté de droit et bonne soirée à tous.
Merci, Monsieur le Doyen. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Nicolas Matossian, and I'm the president of the Friends of the McGill Library. Thank you for braving the elements to join us for the 2011 Frank Scott Lecture. Frank Scott himself, a fearless pioneer in many respects, would have appreciated your coming here tonight. The Friends of the Library began in 1988 as a group of individuals with a deep commitment to the library. It is led by a board that includes community members, alumni, faculty, staff, and students, and it helps in building support for the McGill Library. The Friends are dedicated to enriching the services of the library to the university and to the community, and to enhancing the library's role on campus. Personally, as a friend of the library, I became involved a few years ago, and since then, I've witnessed the amazing impact that the library has on teaching, learning, and research at McGill. I've often referred to the library as the university's fuel tank. Without it, all motor functions cease. And with it, you can accelerate its greatness. As I was, you will probably be astounded to hear that the library last year received over 7 million real visits, not virtual. The McGill Library is a central, vital locus of student life and learning. The more we support its growth, the more McGill benefits. As for this evening's event, the F.R. Scott Lecture was established in 1989 to commemorate a great poet, lawyer, and social philosopher who began his law studies at McGill in 1924. In the 1970s, when Frank Scott was asked to rank the importance of his long list of accomplishments, and I can name a few only, poet, lawyer, teacher, dean of law at McGill University, constitutional lawyer, fighter for civil liberties over many years, political activist for almost 40 years, national chairman of the CCF party, royal commissioner, member of the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism. Scott promptly replied, "Poetry first, and the poetic elements all the way through." Events like this F.R. Scott Lecture help the library to create a strong presence in the community and build awareness of the role of the university's libraries in the life and outreach of McGill. As you might imagine, donor generosity is so important to the library, and it helps us to accomplish a great deal. And I know that many of you here this evening have supported the library, and I thank you for that. For those of you who haven't, I would ask you to consider becoming a member of the Friends of the Library. Your membership in the Friends helps to support a number of free activities, including our Shakespeare Lecture, this F.R. Scott Lecture, and the McLennan Lecture. In the last few years, individuals such as writer Noah Richler, CBC personality Eleanor Wechtel, Mr. Justice Ian Binney of the Supreme Court of Canada, and biographer Charlotte Gray have all graced this stage for us. In the months ahead, we can look forward to talks by Kate Pullinger, winner of the 2009 Governor General's Literary Award for Fiction, and Antonio Cimolino, General Manager of the Stratford Festival, who've accepted our invitations to address us at McGill. Although we don't pay honorariums, I'm sorry about that, Mr. Fish. We don't pay honorariums. We do have expense, and there are costs attached to having these high-profile individuals in our company. So if you're not already one, please join us as a friend of the library. On behalf of the Friends of the Library, I would now like to welcome Dr. Colleen Cook, our new Trenum Dean of Libraries, as of January the 4th. We're delighted that you're here with us, and I would like to call upon you to say a few words about the library.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased and honored to be here. This is my 24th day on the job, and not that I'm counting, I am. I've done an awful lot of things and experienced a lot of things, but I can absolutely tell you that Montreal is one of the most spectacular cities on the planet, and McGill is a very special place, and I have the best job on campus. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Research librarianship is just a wonderful, wonderful job right now. So let me just talk a little bit about this lecture and how pleased I am to be able to address you all this evening. The F.R. Scott Lecture has provided me with the impetus to learn a little bit about two of McGill's luminaries, F.R. Scott and the Honorable Morris J. Fish. A colleague referred me to Scott's poem, Laurentian Shield, where the opening words are, "Hidden in wonder and snow, or sudden with summer, this land stares at the sun in a huge silence." Someone from Texas can really appreciate just what that brings up, what it conjures up. It truly is marvelous, particularly on a day like today, where we get to understand what snow is all about. And despite the fact that I'm from Texas, I am truly enchanted by this white stuff out there. I just wouldn't like to fall in it, I have to admit. I can only imagine that Scott must have been inspired by his time at McGill, and I would like to think that some of his inspiration came from reading or writing in the library. I've also had the chance to somewhat familiarize myself with the distinguished career of tonight's keynote speaker. I understand that Judge Fish's commitment to the right of freedom of expression was likely born of his time as editor-in-chief of the McGill Daily and his time as the correspondent and editorial writer for the Montreal Gazette. Welcome to you, Judge Fish, and thank you. Many of you already know that the McGill Library takes as its motto Information Innovation Service, and that it operates in a huge and complex infosphere. The McGill Library today is not simply about the information resources that we own, which now number almost 7 million items, but also about the people and the community it serves and the transcendent quality that the combination of these two produces. Walk into any of our branch libraries and you will see how the library educates, enriches the lives of library users, engages and inspires them. You'll find researchers combing through books, online catalogs, digital archives, and electronic databases. You'll find a quiet, ninja quiet space to read and study, and then you'll go other places where you'll hear the lively debate and also chatter, laughter, fun, and learning. The library is a place where people can come to be themselves and to become something else. We do change lives. Librarians and library staff make the difference and offer a level of service that's unheard of in today's unprecedented, fast-paced society. Teaching, listening, finding, best described to people who work in libraries and in the McGill Library here. In addition to serving students and faculty, the McGill Library is a community resource for all. Richard Verr, head of our rare books and special collections, likes to say that if someone came up and asked for a medieval manuscript in a museum, the staff might wonder, be a little taken aback, and might even call the security guards. Here, you go to Richard and you say, "I'd like to see, you know, your ordinary medieval manuscript," and he'll say, "Welcome, sit down, I'll find you one." In today's information age, library facilities are teeming with people 12 months of the year. Visits to the library have increased dramatically, and as my as in as Nicholas said, not only in terms of virtual visits, but actual feet treading in. We open some of our facilities 24/7, and in a few weeks that space will be at a premium. Morphing into information hubs for our users, the library is a place to study, stay connected with ever-increasing amounts of information and data, both digital and analog in nature. Thank you truly for welcoming me this evening, and I look forward to meeting many of you in the weeks and months ahead. And now I'd like to call upon Mr. Harvey Yourofsky, Mr. Justice Fish's former law partner and longtime friend, to introduce tonight's speaker.
Thank you very much. It's a bit of a challenge to introduce someone who really needs no introduction, as is the case tonight. But I'll try to meet that challenge. It's really not only an honor, but a pleasure to introduce Morris, Mr. Justice Fish, this evening. As has been mentioned, we were partners. He was my partner and colleague for over 25 years, and he's been my friend for far longer than that. In thinking about what to say in this introduction, I started to think about what Morris Fish has in common with the late Frank Scott. And in turning my mind to that, it struck me that there are several characteristics that they share. The first one is a very imaginative, evocative use of language. Morris Fish loves to turn a phrase, as we say, as certainly did Frank Scott. And I'll give you some illustrations of that in a few moments. Secondly, another characteristic that they shared, a very important one, is an instinctive revulsion by the abuse of authority by people who are given by the state power over other people and abuse that authority with the resulting unfairness that occurs. And I'll give you some illustrations of that. As regards F.R. Scott, the most powerful demonstration of that, as far as I'm concerned, and in my experience, is his role in the case of Roncarelli v. Duplessis. That is the Supreme Court judgment in 1959, where the court, reversing, by the way, a 4-1 decision of the Quebec Court of Appeal, held that the premier of the province, Maurice Duplessis, illegally abused whatever authority he had when he ordered the head of the Quebec Liquor Board, Edouard Archambault, to cancel the liquor permit, the alcohol permit, of Frank Roncarelli, who owned and ran a popular restaurant on Crescent Street in Montreal. And the reason he ordered the head of the Liquor Board to cancel Mr. Roncarelli's permit was that Mr. Roncarelli was in the habit of going to the police station and bailing out Jehovah's Witnesses who had been arrested for distributing their pamphlets on the streets of Montreal without a permit. So in order to punish him, Mr. Duplessis ordered the premier, ordered the head of the liquor board to cancel Mr. Roncarelli's permit, which he did with results that don't require much imagination for a person running a restaurant. That was a landmark judgment that really struck a very potent blow for civil liberties in Quebec. And I have to tell you, by the way, that case was pleaded by Frank Scott with the late A.L. Stein, another graduate, another distinguished Montreal lawyer. I will never forget when, as a first-year law student, and several of my classmates may be here, we had constitutional law with Frank Scott up on the floor that is now offices, the floor above the main floor. And the morning that the Roncarelli decision was delivered by the Supreme Court, we had constitutional law at 10 o'clock. So we arrived, and the judgment, they had just learned about the judgment. And you can imagine the scene in our classroom when our professor, Frank Scott, who had won this wonderful judgment, came in. Professor Maxwell Cohen came into the room. A bottle of champagne was opened. And it was, can you imagine, as a first-year law student, how inspiring that kind of experience is? I should mention, by the way, that Edouard Archambault, who was the head of the liquor board, who obeyed the order to cancel Mr. Roncarelli's permit, subsequently became the chief of the Court of Sessions of Quebec, which was the main criminal court, the chief judge of that court. And Maurice Fish and I spent many of our early years in criminal law practicing in that court, in which Chief Justice Archambault reigned. Now, as far as Maurice Fish is concerned and his revulsion at the abuse of authority, it was demonstrated long before he became a judge. I simply recall the case of Itoshat, where Maurice Fish, as a young lawyer, was sitting in the courtroom when he saw that one of the people appearing was a young member of the Inuit Committee by the name of Itoshat, who had been brought from his home in Porte de la Baleine, which is about 1,000 miles from Montreal in northern Quebec. He'd been brought as a prisoner and faced the court as a prisoner, charged with disturbing the peace while drunk, and resisting a police officer or assaulting a peace officer in the execution of his duties, all of this following a wedding reception in his hometown in Port-la-Baleine. And so he was arrested and brought all the way here to face these charges in a courtroom in Montreal. So Itoshat had no money, he had no friends, he had no residence, and he didn't have the opportunity of looking for witnesses or interviewing witnesses that might help him in his defense, because they were all 1,000 miles away. Maurice Fish, seeing this, offered his services to assist Robert Sachitel, who was the legal aid lawyer appearing in court for Itoshat. And by the way, Sachitel became a wonderful, the late Sachitel, wonderful judge in the youth court of Quebec. And they both made a motion to stay the proceedings on the ground of abuse, because how could anyone have a fair trial in those circumstances? Mr. Justice Albert Malouf, the late Albert Malouf, granted that stay. And it was an important case in the development of the law of abusive process. And as a matter of fact, eventually, as a result of this, the administration of criminal justice in northern Quebec was revamped. And instead of bringing people 1,000 miles from their home to face the court, this was replaced by airplanes flying up there with judges, prosecutors, and defense lawyers together so that people could have their trials in their communities. So that is a potent example of how Maurice Fish reacts to the abuse of authority, and this is long before he became a judge. He was appointed to the Quebec Court of Appeal on July 1st, 1989. And one of his first, well, he was appointed, I think it was July the 1st, And he sat in September in one of in his first cases, and one of the first cases he sat on was a case of R.V. Zurlo, Z-U-R-L-O. It doesn't matter what the case was about, because the issue in the case was revolved around maneuvers by the Crown Prosecutor that, in Judge Fish's words, were vexatious, unfair, and palpably prejudicial to the accused and to a fair trial. And the court, in granting the appeal, Mr. Justice Fish, writing the reasons for the court in that case, said the following. He was comparing what the Crown did in that case with what they had done in a similar vein in another case. And this is what he said. The Crown's recipe in this case was different, but for the appellant, the taste was the same. And so you can imagine what the court did with that conviction. I said that Mr. Justice Fish loves to turn a phrase and loves to use language in a very evocative way. In the Supreme Court of Canada, not long after he was appointed to the court, he participated in a case, Derry versus the Queen, D-E-R-Y. Well, this was 2006, so this was 3 years after he was appointed. He was appointed in August of 2003. In that case, the issue was, we all knew that committing a crime is an offense under Canadian criminal law. Attempting to commit a crime is an offense under Canadian criminal law. Conspiring to commit a crime is an offense under Canadian criminal law. The question was, because someone had been convicted of this, was it an offense in our law to conspire to attempt to commit a crime? And the person was convicted, and the Crown had a theory that because of the common law background of our criminal law, somewhere lay dormant this power, this offense. The court gave a resounding no to that question, and Mr. Justice Fish, writing for the Supreme Court, said the following. I quote, attempting to conspire to commit a substantive offense has never previously been recognized as a crime under Canadian criminal law. I would decline to do so now. To affirm Mr. Derry's conviction, we must find that attempt to conspire, I said conspire to attempt, it's attempt to conspire, has lain dormant within the statutory confines of the criminal code, ready to be roused by a proper sounding of the governing provisions. Like Forgia, J.A., in the Court of Appeal, I would let sleeping laws lie. Justice Fish has never hesitated when he felt that the majority in the Supreme Court was validating authority, the abuse of authority, that he felt should not be validated. He never hesitated, well, I don't know whether he ever hesitated, but he never failed in those circumstances to dissent when he felt that he couldn't go along with the majority. And there are some very significant dissents that he has written, and some of them very recent. In the case of R.V. Singh in 2007, the issue was the admissibility of incriminating statements that a suspect in custody had made to a police interrogator who insisted on interrogating him and questioning him, despite the fact that Mr. Singh said, "I don't want to answer questions. My lawyer told me not to answer questions, and I'm not ready. I'd like to speak to my lawyer before I'm subject to any interrogation." Apparently, he protested about 18 times, but the police investigator just ignored this and went on persistently questioning him until ultimately he obtained from him incriminating statements, which led to his conviction. And the issue in the Supreme Court was whether this conviction was obtained as a result of a violation of Mr. Singh's constitutional rights. The trial judge, the BC Court of Appeal, and the majority in the Supreme Court, this was a 5-4 decision of the Supreme Court in which the majority held that Mr. Singh's constitutional rights were not violated and the incriminating statements were admissible and the conviction stood. But there were 4 judges in the Supreme Court who disagreed with that, and one of them was Justice Fish, and he wrote the judgment, the reasons of the dissenting judges. And this is what he wrote. I'm sorry, I'm just having a bit of a problem with the light here. That's why I'm not good. I quote, "The question on this appeal is whether no means yes. Where a police interrogator, refuses to take no for an answer from a detainee under his complete control. Mr. Singh was deprived not only of his right to silence, but also collaterally of the intended benefit of his right to counsel. These rights are close companions like glove and hand." And he went on to say, "I take care not to be understood to have held that 18, a significant number in other contexts, is of any importance at all in determining whether a detainee's right of silence has been effectively undermined. On the contrary, I favor a purposive approach and find it unnecessary to decide whether 18 times is too many or once is not enough. Constitutional rights do not have to be asserted or invoked a predetermined number of times before the state and its agents are bound to permit them to be exercised freely and effectively. A right that need not be respected after it has been firmly and unequivocally asserted any number of times is a constitutional promise that has not been kept." It's pretty powerful language in a dissent, as I said. More recently, and this is the last case that I will cite. In fact, just in October of 2010, a similar case came before the Supreme Court of Canada, the case of R.V. Sinclair, and it was a similar situation in which, despite the suspect's assertion that he wanted to speak to his lawyer, he didn't want to answer questions until he could speak to his lawyer, the police continued to interrogate him until ultimately they obtained a confession from him. So it was not only a similar question, but the Supreme Court decision was similar to Singh. It was a 5-4 majority upholding the admissibility of the confession, holding that Mr. Sinclair's rights were not violated. The 4 dissenters expressed a very, very vigorous dissent. Mr. Justice Fish wrote with his colleague Justice Lavelle. Madam Justice Abella agreed with those reasons, and Mr. Justice Binney agreed with the result but wrote his own dissent. I simply want to read to you a few words from what Mr. Justice Fish with Mr. Justice Lavelle wrote. And I quote, "With respect, we find it difficult to reconcile the view that the right against self-incrimination ought to be ardently defended with a suggestion that suspects who decide to exercise their right to consult with counsel in order to meaningfully exercise their right to silence must nevertheless endure persistent and sustained custodial interrogation. In our view, the approach of the Chief Justice and Sharon Jay, who are in the majority, obviously, does not pass constitutional muster. So I think these cases illustrate and the two characteristics together, the reaction against abuse of authority on the one hand and the use of language on the other that is very evocative and powerful. Now, I hasten to add, that lest you think that Mr. Justice Fish is always on the side of the accused and against the police, it is simply not so. Because on that very same day that the R.V. Sinclair judgment that I just mentioned was rendered, he and the other dissenters formed part of a unanimous judgment of the court upholding a confession again, because in that case, the suspect who made the confession, even though the police told him that if he wanted to stop to speak to his lawyer, they would stop, never exercised that right. So in that case, Mr. Justice Fish and the other dissenters joined the majority in upholding the confession and saying that the accused's constitutional rights were not violated. I simply want to add that Mr. Justice Fish received an honorary degree from McGill in 2001. And in 2006, which is very relevant to this evening's event, he received the F.R. Scott Award for Distinguished Contribution by Alumni of the Law Faculty. So there is very real connection between Morris Fish and F.R. Scott. And I simply end my introduction of the person who needs no introduction by telling you something that I'm sure very few people know. First of all, the background is Morris Fish met F.R. Scott when he, Fish, was a young reporter for the Montreal Star covering the case of R.V. Brody and Dansky. That was the Lady Chatterley's lover case, in which the Supreme Court had to decide what obscenity means under our law. That case was pleaded in the Supreme Court by Frank Scott, along with Manuel Manny Schachter, a distinguished Montreal lawyer, a graduate of this law faculty, and former Bretonnier, who's sitting up in the sixth or seventh row there. So that's how Fish and Scott met. Their relationship continued for the rest of Scott's life, and Morris and his wife Judy would often be guests at the Scott's home and vice versa. And the anecdote that I think very few people probably know, and I'm sure would be of interest to you, is the following. At a given point in 1981, Frank Scott, a new collection of the poems by F.R. Scott was published. And Scott sent to Morris Fish a copy of the book with an inscription. And the inscription was from F.R. Scott to Morris Fish. A few days later, Morris received a phone call from Scott saying, "Morris, I've been thinking about this, and I think," he said, "I've been talking to Marion about it. I'm not happy at all with the inscription that I put in that book, and I'm sending you a second copy of the book." So a day or two later, a second copy arrived, and in that was the following inscription: "Morris, your friendship and wit continue to delight me. Frank Scott." And so I am delighted to present Mr. Justice Fish to deliver the F.R. Scott Lecture tonight. yet doesn't realize, or perhaps by now he does, looking around the room, is that in anticipation of the bad weather, I implored my family and many of my friends, old and new, to attend, and they have. And to ensure that that would be accompanied by some youth other than students of the university, I brought along two of my wonderful clerks from Ottawa. It's a pleasure to return to McGill, and it's an honor, of course, to give the F.R. Scott Lecture. To have had F.R. Scott as a professor is to be blessed with a lifetime award that only a great academic can bestow. To have known the poet and to have read the poetry of F.R. Scott is to have savored the expression of a man who lived intensely and sensitively on all levels, spiritual, intellectual, political, and sensual. To have enjoyed the friendship of Frank and Marion Scott, as my wife Judy and I did over a period of 25 years, is itself a matter for great celebration. I'm so pleased to have been invited today to honor Frank's memory in this way, recalling Marion with affection and great esteem as well. I remember our first lecture in constitutional law. Frank Scott was a man of great presence, of charisma, of aristocratic bearing. He entered the classroom with his class notes in one hand and the class list in the other. In those days, attendance was compulsory and recorded. Scott held the list in his hand and called the names as follows: Angus, present; Brown, sir; Cohen, silence; Cohen, still no answer. Scott looked up and said, "Has this man no friends?" I also remember very well the first time Frank Scott's name appeared in a favorable light in the Montreal Star, where I worked as a reporter, paying my way through law school. In 1962, Professor Scott was awarded the Loren Pierce Medal in Literature, and I thought that would be that it would be appropriate to mark the occasion with a story in the Star. The older reporters told me that this was a foolhardy adventure, but the publisher would not countenance Frank Scott's name in the Montreal Star because he considered this man more dangerous even than the communists, whose agenda at least we know. I nonetheless arranged an interview with Professor Scott, and in the course of the interview, he referred to one of his poems. I asked in which collection it appeared, and he said it appeared in Events and Signals, which was his second collection, published in 1954. I said, "Well, that's nice. I'll pick up a copy on my way back to the Star." And he said, "No, you won't." I said, "Why not?" He said, "It's out of print. But I do have a copy, and I'd like to give it to you." I thought that was very good and very kind. And he found the copy and inscribed it to Morris Fish on the day he wrote about me. I went off to Quebec City, and I turned in the story, went off to Quebec City, and received a phone call there from the managing editor. And I said, "Oh, no," bearing in mind what I had been told by my fellow journalists at the Star. But the contrary was the case. It was Walter Hearn, a wonderful man. He said, "Morris, I read your piece on F.R. Scott, and I really liked it.
Do you think you could turn it into the Saturday feature? And I thought that would be a great idea. So I arranged to see Scott again, went up, had a wonderful interview, in the course of which he referred to a second poem. And I said, is that in Events and Signals? And he said, no, that's in Overture, my first book, which was published 9 years earlier, 1945, first collection. And so I said, all right, well, I'll pick it up. He said, oh, no, you won't. It's out of print. And I said, well, that's too bad. He said, I think I have one last copy, and I'd like to give it to you. I steadfastly refused to accept the book. He nonetheless reached for it, put it on his desk, and inscribed it as follows: To Morris Fish, a test of his receptivity. I failed the test, but I still have the book. I remember as well the first and only time that I saved F.R. Scott from political infamy and legal jeopardy. In 1967, he rang me up, and I could tell that he was quite distraught. He asked whether I would come up to the law faculty as soon as I could. I did. When I entered his office, he placed the paper in my hand. I looked at it and immediately recognized the ominous political and legal consequences. It was a summons. The Montreal Police Department charged our legendary man of the left with having turned right. Illegally. On a red light. I could see the headlines. F.R. Scott, homme célèbre de gauche, effectue un virage à droite. I knew that I had to do everything I could to save not only the man, but perhaps an entire political movement. Without the benefit of the charter, I managed to resolve the case. And Frank Scott insisted that I send him an account, which I did. And my account read something like this: for professional services, including attendance at your offices, attendance at our offices, meetings with Crown prosecutors and police officers, research, preparation, disbursements, in all, our total fee, one poem. This was Scott's reply. Dear Morris, how can one repay a gift of freedom? Eternal gratitude is the least one can offer. As for a poem, it comes when it comes. Vendremos, as the Spaniards say. Love, peace, joy, Frank Scott. Over the years, Frank Scott would send me, as you by now know, copies of his books of poems and of his anthologies, including The Blasted Pine, which he did with A.G.M. Smith, the author of Why is the McGill Daily? Asked the pessimist sourly. Thank God, said the optimist gaily, that it isn't hourly. Frank Scott's inscription in one book is, one man's meat is another man's poisson. Before I turn from the poisson to the meat of my lecture, allow me to tell you a word about, to share with you, its venerable origins. My third year essay at the law faculty, written for Professor Scott a half century ago, was on a matter of pressing legal, sociological, and political importance, the effect of alcohol on the Canadian Constitution. Professor Scott approved the result, but no one has, to my knowledge, read my paper since. I thought this would be the perfect occasion to do so. It runs a mere 120 pages, and then there are the endnotes. Alas, I couldn't find it. And so I did, however, find an article I wrote for the Montreal Star, an editorial page, derived of the same theme, and it began as follows. Liquor has exerted a staggering influence on Canada's constitution, more staggering, in fact, than on the constitution of Canada's first prime minister. Yet, while many historians have commented on the drinking habits of Sir Johnny Macdonald, few seem to have noticed that alcohol has played so important a role in our national legal development. It is my duty to attempt to fill the void. And in honor of my old professor and friend, F.R. Scott, I'd like to return to that topic. Someone said you could not find a more appropriate audience than a group of McGill Law students. And for the rest, all the others who are here, your attendance is testimony to the fact that you too share an abiding interest in this long-ignored subject. Historian Will Ferguson has written, in reference to Confederation and to the drinking habits of our first Prime Minister, I quote, that Canada, like many a child, was conceived under the influence of alcohol. Ferguson could equally have been writing about the development of the Canadian Constitution. A surprising number of our foundational constitutional cases began as disputes over the sale, licensing, and prohibition of alcohol. A quick list of key constitutional cases from the 19th and early 20th century reads like a liquor board document. Local prohibition, Manitoba license holders, Canada Temperance Federation, Nat Bell Liquors, Consolidated Distilleries, Canadian Pacific Wine Brewers and Maltsters. I could go on. It is from these early liquor cases that we see, it is in these first liquor cases that we see the first discussions of the double aspect doctrine of paramountcy, of peace, order, and good government, and of the legal significance, some would say, if any, of the original understandings of the British North America Act. Comment expliquer l'abondance de causes ayant trait à l'alcool? La réglementation de l'alcool a constitué l'une des grandes questions juridiques, politiques et sociales et morales de la fin du 19e siècle et du début du 20e. Précisément au moment où les tribunaux étaient saisis pour la première fois d'importantes questions constitutionnelles. Il s'agissait d'une question juridique épineuse en raison de l'incertitude entourant la compétence en matière d'alcool, les pouvoirs d'interdiction ou de réglementation de la vente d'alcool semblent se situer à l'intersection de plusieurs dispositions de l'acte de l'Amérique du Nord britannique. Il s'agissait d'un problème moral épineux parce que le pays était divisé entre les ouvriers dont la vie sociale était axée sur l'alcool et des avocats de la tempérance qui voyaient dans l'alcool un des maux de la vie moderne. Et il s'agissait d'un problème politique épineux parce que les hommes politiques des trois paliers de gouvernement, fédéral, provincial et municipal, souhaitaient avoir compétence en matière de réglementation d'alcool afin de pouvoir tirer parti des occasions de favoritisme et des revenus associés au permis d'Ancon. So today I'd like to discuss with you how alcohol has shaped our constitution from its earliest days and how liquor licensing enabled Frank Scott to make a pivotal and lasting contribution to the rule of law in Canada. Harvey has helped me in that regard by telling you about the Roncarelli and Du Plessis case. I will not repeat what Harvey said. I will mention that the current McGill Law Journal has a wonderful volume on the legacy of Roncarelli and Du Plessis, which arose from a seminar held in August of last year, more or less. Yes. Held last year. I think it's useful to begin with a discussion of two realities of 19th century Canadian life: the centrality of drinking to daily routines and the social and political backlash that widespread drunkenness caused. The most obvious reason why so many constitutional cases involved alcohol is that there was a lot of drinking going on in 19th century Canada, and not much else. In her history of the prohibition movement in Canada, Jan Nowell describes alcohol as the caffeine of daily life. Many families, children included, would begin the day with a stiff shot of whiskey. As one chronicler reported, I quote, "Whiskey was served to each member of the household in the morning. It was considered to be a precaution against colds and to enable one to do hardy work." Now, of course, we have cold effects. Even nursing mothers would regularly drink for fortitude. In Montreal, residents would add brandy to their water to make sure it was safe to drink. Some, it seems, still think this to be a sensible precaution. Following breakfast, men would drink throughout the day, even and especially while at work. The professional classes were no different than their laboring counterparts. Lawyers and judges would drink on the job to, and I quote from one of the professors of the time, "to keep up their eloquence." My own eloquence, as you can see, is entirely natural. Although I must say, having Harvey read some of the things I wrote made me feel more eloquent than I can aspire to be, viva voce, and I thank you. When English philanthropist Sir James Silk Buckingham toured North America in the 1830s, he said that in 1 hour's carriage ride in Quebec City, he saw, and I quote, "more taverns and spirit shops with drunken inmates than we had witnessed in all our 3 years' journey in the United States." Though public drunkenness was common in the first half of the 19th century, drunks were rarely thrown in jail. When they were, they encountered a pleasant surprise. Many jailers were licensed to sell alcohol. A drunk needn't even have left his cell to keep the buzz going. The importance of alcohol to daily life reached the highest levels of Canadian society. Alan, this is for us. An 1838 committee report in the Nova Scotia legislature found that the judiciary included a number of, quote, "ruddy-complexioned gentlemen," a euphemism for their frequent and great consumption of alcoholic beverages. Politicians were no different. When the Parliament of Upper Canada sat for the first time in 1792, it held its proceedings in a tavern at Niagara-on-the-Lake. not the only time, you might say, that parliamentary debates resemble an evening at the pub. Licensing of alcoholic beverages began in Quebec very early, in 1648. And by 1838, licensing regimes were in place in all the colonies. From the sources I've examined, it seems, however, that police officers and magistrates devoted little time to enforcement and still less to abstinence. Other early laws targeted, somewhat comically, particular drinking behaviors. One decree banned drunken driving of horse-drawn carriages. Another decree in 1791 prohibited the sale of liquor to canoemen shooting the rapids of the Ottawa River. My law clerk says that great Canadian pastime, drunk canoeing, was almost killed in its infancy. Social attitudes toward alcohol began to change in the 1820s when temperance societies were founded across the country to promote sobriety. The temperance movement initially targeted Canada's alcohol-induced social ills in small steps. An early Montreal temperance society required its members to limit themselves to, I quote, six small glasses of liquor a day. Nevertheless, pamphlets, poems, and songs were distributed throughout the country to discourage drinking. An 1870 song was typical of the movement. We were so happy till thought, I won't sing it. You'll be great. Those of you who know me will be grateful. We were so happy till father drank rum, then all our sorrow and trouble begun. Mother grew paler and wept every day. Baby and I were too hungry to play. Slowly they faded, and one summer's night found their dear faces all silent and white. These social pressures had an effect. By the 1850s, approximately 500,000 people, the small population, promised to abstain from alcohol. I'm not sure that the records confirm that they all did. But temperance advocates quickly began to focus on legislative efforts rather than on their own educational efforts. And a flurry of legislative activity followed. British Columbia passed the Habitual Drunkards Act, which permitted the wives of drunkards to obtain legal title to their husband's property. Many provinces created interdiction lists, which criminalized the sale of alcohol to known drunkards. And there were a whole variety throughout the provinces of other legislative initiatives, including one which may well have had the contrary effect. Some provinces barred gambling, the playing of games, and most forms of entertainment from taverns. The intent was not to ban drunken billiards on the ground that it was a dangerous endeavor, but to make men less likely to visit the tavern. Of course, the law also meant that once you arrived at the tavern, there was nothing to do but drink. Many municipalities also passed laws barring liquor license holders, though not drunkards, from holding public office. Over time, the objective of the temperance movement changed from a reduction in drinking to overnight to outright prohibition. And there were a series of statutes which I had intended. I should have said that I have divided my lecture into three parts. I mentioned this to Dean Jutta earlier. I intend today to deal with the first part and to leave the other two parts to next year's F.R. Scott lecture and perhaps the year after that. So there were various statutes, including the Canada Temperance Act, and this culminated in 1883 when the federal government enacted the McCarthy Act. It was this flurry of legislative measures to regulate, reduce, and prohibit drinking that triggered many of the foundational federalism cases in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Two important constitutional questions needed to be answered. First, which level of government, the federal or the provincial, had jurisdiction to regulate the sale, consumption, and production of alcohol? Second, should any distinction be drawn between the power to regulate alcohol and the power to prohibit its consumption entirely? These questions would need to be answered despite an almost complete lack of precedent to guide the courts. The answers, the questions were challenging, and the quest to find them was challenging, both politically and legally, for several reasons. First, as we've seen, because of the role of alcohol in daily life, a major social issue. Temperance advocates relentlessly lobbied governments to enact prohibition, while opponents of prohibition were equally passionate and violent in resisting its effects. Craig Herron recounts that in one plebiscite in Toronto in 1877, hundreds of working men surrounded the voting stations to intimidate supporters of prohibition. When the results revealed that prohibition had failed, had been rejected, 10,000 people joined in a celebratory torch-like parade. The more comical example comes from what was then the town of Guelph. When residents voted down prohibition, drinkers led a parade down the streets with a float featuring Gambrinus, the god of beer. "I know Guelph," said a Montrealer on hearing the news. A second complicating factor was that there were pronounced regional differences in attitudes toward alcohol. In 1898, Sir Wilfrid Laurier held what was the first national plebiscite on the subject, and it resulted in a slim majority, 51.2% voting for prohibition. But curiously, in the Maritime provinces, the vote was 80% in favor of prohibition. In Quebec, 80% were opposed. Third, the power to regulate alcohol brought several important political advantages. I've mentioned liquor fees, import duties were a significant source of revenue, and also a significant method of patronage in order to gain partisan political support. Liquor licensing also provided a rudimentary form of social welfare. A poor widow falls on hard times, give her a liquor license, free, so that she can earn a living selling alcohol. And so there ensued, as I've mentioned, a whole series of cases, beginning with Severn, a case called Severn, and followed by Russell and then Hodge and a number of others. In R.V. Fredericton, the court held that the Canada Temperance Act fell squarely within the federal government's trade and commerce power and added two important findings, important but perhaps unnecessary to the result. The first was that provincial governments could not prohibit the sale of alcohol because provincial prohibition would interfere with the federal government's ability to collect import duties on alcohol if it so chose. Second, the court in that case gave birth in these terms to the enduring doctrine of paramountcy. I quote, "The right to regulate trade and commerce," said the court, "is not to be overridden by any local legislation in reference to any subject over which power is given to the local legislature." The Supreme Court's decision in Fredericton was not appealed to the Privy Council. Only 2 years later, however, the Privy Council addressed the vires, the constitutionality, of the Canada Temperance Act in Russell and the Queen. The Board's approach was markedly different than modern practice. Rather than determining whether prohibition fell under an enumerated power in either Section 91, which is the federal jurisdiction, or 92, the board only considered whether the power fell under Section 92. If it did not, the board reasoned that the power necessarily fell under the federal government's peace, order, and good government power. We see here an expansive interpretation of the residual nature of the POGG, or Peace, Order, and Good Government Clause. It covers all powers not held by the provinces. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the board found that the power to prohibit was not contained in Section 92. It rejected the province's argument that the provincial power to raise revenue through retail licensing extended to prohibition. Prohibition could not fall under the power to raise revenue through licensing, because quite obviously it meant there would be none with total prohibition. The board also rejected the argument that the Canada Temperance Act fell within the provincial power over matters of a purely local or private nature. Although the Act empowered local prohibition, the Act applied to communities across the country, and so prohibition was considered not only illegal, but a national evil. Les décisions de la Cour suprême dans Severn et Fredericton et celles du Conseil privé dans Russell ont constitué des victoires décisives pour le gouvernement fédéral qui jouissait désormais d'une compétence exclusive pour réglementer la fabrication et la vente, en gros, de l'alcool et aussi pour instituer la prohibition. En outre, le pouvoir du gouvernement fédéral en matière de paix, ordre et bon gouvernement avait été interprété de manière large, tandis que celui des provinces à l'égard des matières de nature locale avait été grandement restreint. La grande question qui semblait alors se poser était celle-ci: jusqu'où s'étendrait la compétence du gouvernement fédéral? To surprise, however, the law took a U-turn. The Privy Council issued a series of decisions scaling back the federal power. The first was Hodge versus the Queen, which I've already mentioned. And the Privy Council in that case rejected a claim by introducing what has come to be known as an important constitutional law doctrine, the double aspect doctrine. The federal government was dealt another blow, and the provinces gained another round, in the McCarthy Act reference. The McCarthy Act was Sir John A. Macdonald's attempt to wrest control of liquor licensing from provincial governments, in particular Oliver Mowat's government in Ontario. There's this ongoing feud in the public press between Macdonald and Mowat. Both the Supreme Court and the Privy Council struck down the McCarthy Act without even giving reasons. Together, Hodge and the McCarthy Act reference made clear that the provinces had exclusive jurisdiction to regulate the local sale of alcohol. The provincial governments soon completed a trifecta of victories in the local prohibition reference. The Privy Council had to decide whether provincial governments had jurisdiction to enact prohibition. In dispute were the many provincial statutes that empowered towns to prohibit the sale of alcohol. This issue, of course, was nearly identical to the issue in Russell. There, the Privy Council considered whether the federal government had jurisdiction to enact prohibition and found that it did. Moreover, the board had grounded federal jurisdiction on its finding that Section 92 did not grant the province's jurisdiction to prohibit the sale of alcohol. Surely the board could not now find that provincial governments had jurisdiction. Well, that's exactly what the Privy Council, in fact, did. The board held that both the provincial and federal governments had concurrent jurisdiction to enact prohibition schemes. The local prohibition reference is one of the earliest judicial decisions granting both the federal and provincial governments power to regulate in the same area. The local prohibition reference was followed by a series of liquor cases that affirmed provincial rights, including the Manitoba license holders case and Natbell Liquors, where the board upheld provincial prohibitions on the sale of alcohol in Manitoba and Alberta. The key to the Act's constitutionality was that they only applied, acts in the plural, they only applied to intra-provincial sales of alcohol. They expressly did not prohibit interprovincial or international transactions. And there is a bit of irony to students of comparative constitutional law. So here in Canada, in the UK, but in respect of Canada, the board attributed jurisdiction over intra-provincial sales to the provinces, and jurisdiction over inter-provincial sales to Parliament. Despite its unrestricted wording, the federal trade and commerce power had been limited to a power over only inter-provincial trade and commerce. Ironically, during this same period in the United States, the more narrowly drafted federal power over interstate commerce had effectively expanded into a power over all trade and commerce. All of these cases set the stage for the great legal denouement of the period in the 1946 case, Canada Temperance Federation, in which the board reaffirmed that both the federal and provincial governments had concurrent jurisdiction to prohibit alcohol. Two portions of the board's reasoning are of prime importance. First, it developed the modern formulation of the national concern branch of the peace, order, and government power of the Parliament of Canada. And what the court said is, and I quote, "The true test must be found in the real subject matter of the legislation. If it is such that it goes beyond local or provincial concern or interests and must from its inherent nature be the concern of the Dominion as a whole, then it fell within the peace, order, and good government power." Second issue was whether this national concern branch justified federal jurisdiction over alcohol. This was by no means an easy question, yet surprisingly, the board held that it didn't even have to answer it. Russell had already decided 60 years earlier that prohibition was a matter of national concern. For the board, the decision was, and I quote, "firmly embedded in the constitutional law of Canada, and it's impossible now to depart from it." After Canada Temperance Federation, liquor cases continued reaching the courts for several decades, 1980, LeBlanc Brewing, which held that the Supreme Court where the Supreme Court held that the federal government did not have jurisdiction to prescribe standards for light beers. To discuss all of these cases today would be an imposition on your Constitution and mine. I nonetheless do wish to add one word about the Roncarelli case, and that is to underline its importance in Canadian constitutional law and in the constitutions and the constitutional law of other countries, more and more today looking at Canada's constitutional and other public law developments. The Supreme Court agreed in that case with Mr. Roncarelli and issued a seminal endorsement of the rule of law. "In public regulation of this sort," said the court, "there is no such thing as absolute or untrammeled discretion. What could be more malicious than to punish a licensee for having done what he had an absolute right to do in a matter utterly irrelevant to the Liquor Act. It may be that no legal combination other than A.L. Stein, who was mentioned by Harvey. And by the way, Frank Scott always said to me that he would not have had the courage. I'm not sure that I ever accepted that, because he was a fearless man of great courage. But he always insisted that he would not have had the courage to go at Premier du Plessis the way A.L. Stein, even equally and perhaps even less fearless, more fearless or less fearless? No fear, was able to go. And Scott, on the other hand, had the constitutional authority, the intellectual authority and resources to convert what seemed to be a dispute of great principle, but a dispute that might otherwise not have resulted in the law, that in the improvement, in the change, in the fundamental change of the law that occurred through the participation of the great F.R. Scott, whose memory we honor today. And what can we take away from the liquor cases that we've discussed today? In my view, at least three things. First, we see the constitutional legacy that the liquor cases have left. It is in these cases that we are introduced, as I mentioned at the outset, to paramountcy, to double aspect doctrine, to concurrent jurisdiction, and to the reach of the peace order and good government clause, along with the local matters, trade and commerce, property and civil rights. All of these fundamental constitutional doctrines finding their early development and acquiring their present shape in the liquor cases or cases relating to alcohol and licensing, some of which I've referred to today. Second, from these cases, we see the U-turns, pauses, and dead ends that often arise during the interpretation of constitutional questions of first impression. The courts are perhaps not the first to have had difficulty walking in a straight line after encountering alcohol. While much of the reasoning in these cases has been abandoned, by the time we reach the local prohibition reference, the results are clear and closely resemble the modern state of Canadian law, today's Canadian law, Canadian constitutional law. Third, we see courts responding to and grappling with the social and political pressures of the time. The liquor cases frequently turn on the court's characterization of alcohol as a national evil, a social evil, a local evil, a matter of order and safety, or merely a good to be traded in commerce. Resolving that question inevitably drew the courts into the passionate social debates of the late 19th century. Similarly, we see the courts responding to the intense jurisdictional fight between the federal and provincial governments. It's perhaps not surprising that the Privy Council came down right in the middle in the local prohibition reference, concurrent jurisdiction for all. The challenge, of course, was that courts needed to grapple with these social and political pressures while simultaneously addressing foundational concerns, foundational issues, foundational questions in constitutional law. Would our constitutional law have developed differently if it had been some other, less socially divisive issue that had prompted early interpretation of our Constitution? I am uncertain of the answer, but I can say with confidence that alcohol served as the trigger for much of our early constitutional development. And if you would permit me to reflect on the fact that I should perhaps not have asked F.R. Scott for a poem, not the poet. I should have asked the poem. And here is what F.R. Scott has written on that subject. Poem talking to poet. Write me a poem, you said. So I sat by the window, minding my business. After a little, you asked, will it be modern and free? I cannot tell you beforehand, I answered. I am not master here. I watched the trees carve nightmares in the night, heard dusty winds borrow the sound of tears. Then it came, and so it was, and lo, there it was. Here is your poem, I said. I do not think it will live long. You sighed, then trembled on my fingertips, being yourself the writing on the page.
Mesdames, Messieurs, c'est à moi que revient le privilège d'exprimer toute notre gratitude à Morris Fish pour ce tour de force ce soir. When he was appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada at the formal ceremony marking his nomination to the Court, Chief Justice of Canada, Beverly McLaughlin, described him as one of the most indefatigable storytellers that you will ever encounter. And she said, indeed, quote, if I may paraphrase another storyteller, Nobel laureate I.B. Singer, one can find in Morris Fish's spirit, as in the Yiddish spirit, expressions of pious joy, lust for life, longing for the Messiah, patience and deep appreciation of human individuality. There is a quiet humor in Morris, and a gratitude for every day of life, every crumb of success, each encounter of love, end quote. And I think tonight we were witness to exactly those qualities in the presentation that we heard. Il y a évidemment dans la manière Morris Fish, un son Morris Fish. Morris est avantagé par une voix de baryton absolument unique. J'ai l'air d'un pipsqueak, je crois, après cette présentation. Une voix, the Morris Fish sound is soothing and intimate, I think, which is, makes this lighting most appropriate. But there is more to Morris Fish than the sound. There is insight, a unique blend of humor and thoughtful perspective on the things that are around us. Some of you may have been surprised by the title of his presentation. Some of you may have come here to understand clearly what is the effect of alcohol on the Canadian Constitution. Seriously. And that's in the title. Today, I think most of the younger generation is addicted to something a little different, not alcohol, but texting and Facebooking. And maybe 50 years from now, one of my students here will come and deliver the 71st F.R. Scott Lecture and will speak on the effect of texting and Facebook on global democratic governance. Seriously. Now, the tradition in this institution is to have a reception after a presentation of this nature. And in light of the topic, I hesitate to invite you to come over to the atrium and share a drink. Maybe we should have had the reception before the presentation. Nonetheless, it's too late to... Les pots cassés, hein? Le dentifrice est sorti du tube. Il est trop tard pour changer. I invite you to join us and join Morris Fish in the atrium for maybe one drink, if you may. Thank you, Morris, very much for this delightful evening.